Now on Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up a two-day visit to Beijing, China. He met with President Xi Jinping and other Chinese government officials. The main official goal of the trip was to reestablish diplomacy and stability between the two countries. Blinken's the highest-level American official to visit China in nearly 5 years. Here he is talking to the press afterward.
Both the United States and China have an obligation to manage this relationship responsibly. Doing so serves the best interests of the United States, of China, indeed, of the world. We are clear-eyed about the challenges posed by the PRC. The United States will advance a vision for the future that we share with so many others, a free, open, stable, and prosperous world, with countries upholding and updating the rules-based order that has, for years, safeguarded peace and security globally. To shape that future, we start with diplomacy, including with China. I came to Beijing to strengthen high-level channels of communication, to make clear our positions and intentions in areas of disagreement, and to explore areas where we might work together when our interests align on shared transnational challenges. And we did all of that.
We're taking a look at that high-level visit and U.S.-China relations, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you hope that the U.S. Can cooperate, cool down tensions with China? What are some of the main areas of concern you have with either side of the relationship? What questions do you have about this Secretary of State's visit to China? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jing Sun is a professor of political science at the University of Denver. He received his PhD from UW-Madison. Jing, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you so much.
I don't think anybody thought, you know, this was going to be a magical solution to all the tensions between the U.S. and China. That said, what did both sides here, the Chinese leadership, Secretary of State Blinken, hope to accomplish with this visit?
Well, I think this is Antony Blinken's visit is certainly welcome news in the short run. So what it has done to the U.S.-China relations is it kind of halted the almost freefall of these most important bilateral relations in the world. And China and America attained some short-term goals through Antony Blinken's visit. But over the long term, I remain deeply concerned about the trajectory of Sino-U.S. relations.
What do you see as the biggest areas of concern for that relationship?
Well, it is still the issue about China and America on a path of a head-on collision, particularly over the issue of Taiwan. So this is the part where actually China got some, you know, short-term goal, satisfied through Antony Blinken's visit. But in a press conference, Blinken stated that America does not support Taiwan independence. That's exactly what Beijing wanted to hear from America's top diplomat. And in exchange for that, what America got from Beijing is China has finally agreed to talk, to resume this communication channel between the two countries. So in the wake of Antony Blinken's visit, what will happen next is we should expect a number of cabinet members from the Biden administration that will be headed for Beijing to have talks with their Chinese counterparts. Chinese Foreign Minister Qin Gang has also agreed to come to Washington to meet with Blinken to further their conversation on U.S.-China relations. So that's welcome news to the U.S.
How have U.S.-China relationships changed between the Trump administration and now the Biden administration?
Well, good question. The way that I see this is, despite the so many differences between the Biden administration and the Trump administration, if there's one area where Biden basically continue to walk on the path of the Trump administration, it is actually the China policy. There is this actually bipartisan consensus emerging in the U.S. that America need to stand up to the Chinese, need to confront China. The game of engagement is now over. So this is actually one area. In a sense, Democrats and Republicans now are actually trying to compete with each other to see who can out-hawk the other, who can sound more assertive to the Chinese authorities in contrast to the other party. So this is actually one area I see a lot of continuity between the Biden and Trump administrations.
We are talking about U.S.-China relations with Jing Sun from the University of Denver. after Antony Blinken, Secretary of State's visit to China to meet with the leader of China, Xi Jinping. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want leaders of both U.S. parties talking tough on China, acting tough? If so, how? Do you see room for cooperation? Join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Want to listen some more to Secretary of State Blinken talking here about how Taiwan factors into U.S.-China competition and potential cooperation?
Fundamental to us in that is the understanding that any differences regarding Taiwan will be resolved peacefully. That is foundational to how we understand our relationship. And for the past almost five decades, this is an issue that China and the United States have managed responsibly. We remain committed to our One China policy with the three communiques, the Taiwan Relations Act, the six assurances. We do not support Taiwan's independence. We've made clear that we oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo by either side. We've been clear and consistent in our policy, and it's very important that we preserve the status quo that has helped maintain peace and stability across the strait for decades. So I reiterated that to our Chinese counterparts. President Biden has also made that repeatedly clear in his engagements with China.
So this is really a weird situation to me, Jing. China says Taiwan doesn't exist. It's a breakaway part of China. The United States officially says Taiwan, we don't recognize their independence, but Taiwan functions as an independent state, an independent government with its own army, etc. How can we sustain that indefinitely with this sort of like diplomatic fiction?
Well, I think actually you raise a really insightful observation. The issue is how we can continue to have this strategic ambiguity over the issue of Taiwan. Like you mentioned, you know, China never, in Beijing's eyes, Taiwan does not exist. It is a part of the People's Republic of China. But what America has done in the past diplomatic communications with China is to say that America acknowledges China's position. So which means we, you know, that's what China says, and we heard what China is saying, but we neither agree nor disagree with the Chinese about whether Taiwan is a part of it. So we have been developing this unofficial in name only relationship with Taiwan, a very robust network of economic, social, and cultural exchanges with this vibrant democracy over the past three decades. But the problem is, what is the shelf life of this policy? So this is an area, I'm afraid, that despite the statements made by Antony Blinken and despite the statements made by China, that both China and America are sensing some fundamental changes that are happening to US-China, to the issue of Taiwan. And both sides are feeling that time is not on their side. And on some, that they have to be proactive to make some changes happen to advance, to put forward their own national interests. This is where the danger lies.
The big worry, I think, globally is what if China takes military action to end the de facto independence of Taiwan, invades it? How much does that prospect worry you? How likely do you see that being? Of course, we can't predict the future, but how much does it worry you?
It worries me greatly. Actually, I had multiple conversations off record with Chinese media, friends working for the Chinese media and working for the Chinese government. And I walked away from those interviews feeling very pessimistic. And at least to the people that I talked to in China, the issue is not whether an invasion will happen. Of course, in Mandarin, they don't call that an invasion. They call it, reunification campaign. You know, when it's not an issue about whether this will happen. It's an issue of when this may happen. So the CIA actually kind of agree with the Chinese sentiment by saying 2027 is a particularly interesting year, vital year that we should be looking at.
Why? Why 2027?
I think this is actually some kind of a math is involved here. So what happens is the People's Republic of China was founded in 1949. So by 2049, China will be celebrating, the PRC will be celebrating its 100th anniversary of the founding of the Republic. Now, China expects, or President Xi expects, in the wake of Chinese invasion of Taiwan, China will face Western isolation and condemnation. There will be widespread severe sanctions imposed on China. But at the same time, he also places bets on if the invasion could go ahead efficiently, if China can take Taiwan in a relatively short time window. Memory in international relations is notoriously short. So give it another 10 years, 15 years for you gradually the West to quote unquote accept the fact that that Taiwan is solidly in China's pocket, they will have to resume contact with China. So give it another 10 or 15 years for that to happen. And couple that with the Chinese invasion of Taiwan, he still wants a big celebration by 2049 of the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Republic. So that's when the CIA actually reaches the conclusion that somewhere around 2027 to 2030, that's the time window that Beijing could be particularly enticed, so to speak, to invade Taiwan.
We're talking to Jing Sun, professor of political science at the University of Denver, about Secretary of State Antony Blinken's recent diplomatic trip to China. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll look at the economic links and the economic competition between the U.S. and China. What do you want to see from the U.S. government when it comes to our reliance on China for so much of our supply chain? Does your business involve selling things to China or things made in China? What do you want to see from U.S. leadership when it comes to the relationship with China, support from Taiwan? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jing Sun, professor of political science at the University of Denver, telling us about the outcome of Secretary of State Antony Blinken's diplomatic visit to China. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How important is it for the U.S. to have a good relationship with China? Or do you want to see a tougher talk from the White House, from Congress, when it comes to human rights, economic issues, Taiwan, and more? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jing, I'm looking at a list of the biggest economies in the world. The two countries we're talking about, U.S. and China, number one and number two. Can you talk about the economic ties between the two countries, the interdependence, and the competition, too?
Well, when it comes to U.S.-China economic ties, and or you know even broader, wrong China's economic relations with the West, I think both China and leaders in the West are walking on a very tight rope. So on one hand, for both Beijing and for Washington and for leaders in the EU, they're talking about de-risking. They try to somehow reduce their reliance on the other. But on the other hand, they also realize complete decoupling is impossible and could become disastrous to all the parties involved. But this is where actually all the tricky things will begin to unfold when you talk about de-risking rather than decoupling. So where are the issues to be, you know, somehow the two economic entities should depart from each other? Where are the areas where the two will continue to collaborate? This is the rationale makes sense to all the parties involved, but when it comes to the actual execution of this de-risking policy, it's still very foggy.
In the event of a war, say a Chinese reunification campaign, as you said they call it there, or invasion of Taiwan, you mentioned China would expect massive sanctions. How much does China's economy depend on selling stuff to the United States and the EU?
Well, what President Xi has been doing in the past 2 or 3 years is he has been, you know, touring around the country trying to sell this new idea called internal circulation. So this is actually done in the context of in the event that China invades Taiwan and China will be cut off from the West, global, international trade network. So what differentiates China from smaller countries like Japan or South Korea is China has an immense internal market. So she is hoping that by promoting his internal circulation agenda, that China could continue to at least survive in the short run. And then again, he really places bets on his hope that the invasion of Taiwan will be carried out in a relatively efficient manner, that before the world could respond in a more forceful way, Taiwan is already part of China.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Michigan. Tom, hi.
Hey, hi there. Well, one of the questions I've wondered is why the British had to turn over Hong Kong. I mean, the People's Republic of China wasn't formed until 1949. Why did they have to even turn that lease over? And does the turnover of Hong Kong does that put in the Chinese mind like, okay, well, this is one step closer to the unified China, one China idea, and therefore substantiates their move to claim Taiwan?
Gotcha, Tom. You're breaking up a little, but point taken. Jing, China taking back Hong Kong after the British lease expired. Does that mean like next in line in some ways was Taiwan, as Tom I think is saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When China took Hong Kong back in 1997, it was allegedly going to practice one country, two systems, a system that, a formula that we now know has failed miserably. But at the time, when China was selling this imposing one country, two systems formula on Hong Kong, it was doing so not as a way to somehow lure Hong Kong. Hong Kong already became a part of China. It's really as a way to try to persuade the Taiwanese, come and join us. You will continue to maintain your economic and social and political system. All that I want is geographically, you will become a part of China.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom. Since this Blinken visit just yesterday now, President Biden in a campaign event referred to Chinese President Xi Jinping as a dictator. The Chinese government responded unhappily. They called that absurd and irresponsible. Can one comment like that reverse what appeared to be the soothing of the tensions that we saw from the Blinken visit?
Probably not at this point. I think probably by just following news coverage in this country, that they know that President Biden has a reputation for saying things that people were not quite expecting him to say on that particular spot, on that particular occasion. And Biden made that remark at a fundraiser event. So Beijing already made its point. It criticized what Biden said as immensely irresponsible. But at the same time, given the momentum that both powers just gained through Anthony Blinken's visit, I feel at least in the short run, we are going to expect some positive movements from both countries.
One point I've seen made is that one thing that we didn't get here was direct military-to-military communications. So that's in case of planes fly too close to each other or ships sail too close to each other in open waters. There's a risk of tensions escalating, somebody accidentally shooting at somebody else. The idea that we want military leaders to be able to pick up a phone, get in touch right away, and tamp things down. How important is that?
It is extremely important, but this is where an area, unfortunately, these two powers are still deadlocked. So what happens is the reason the Chinese refuse to talk to the U.S. military is because the Chinese defense minister right now is under sanction by the U.S. This is the person that while he was, before he became the defense minister, he was in charge of getting weapons for the Chinese military, and he purchased some advanced Russian fighter jets at the time Russia was under Western sanction. So as a result of that, we are putting this person on our sanction list. And later this person was promoted by President Xi to become the defense minister. So for the Chinese, their rationale is they can't talk to to the US when their top soldier is under US sanction. While for us, for the US, America has made it abundantly clear that the sanction per se should not become an obstacle for the two militaries to talk to each other to reduce the possibility of any accidents that happen between the two.
Time for one more caller. Scott is with us in Mequon. Scott, hi.
Hi, yes. One thing, I've been to Taiwan over 20 times in the last 20 years. I spent probably two or three months a year there. One thing that nobody's saying is China controlled Taiwan for, I don't know how long, but up until around 1900. In 1900, right around there, Japan took control of Taiwan, and Japan controlled Taiwan until Chiang Kai-shek fled there from China. So if Taiwan belongs to China, the U.S. belongs to England by that rationale. It's just there's no way it could happen. There's no way that they're saying that they used to control. It's been well over 100 years.
Gotcha. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. And Jing, that makes me think, what do we know about what the people in Taiwan think about the idea of a one-child policy?
Well, people in Taiwan are overwhelmingly rejecting China's one-country, two-systems formula, even before the, you know, is catastrophic failure in Hong Kong, you know, the mass pro-democracy movement that was suppressed by the Chinese Communist Party. Even before that, only people in the very low single digit, 4%, 3% of the Taiwanese would support Taiwan to be reintegrated into the People's Republic of China under the one country, two systems formula. But at the same time, people who are in favor of outright independence are also in the minority. You have consistently 60%, 70% of the people in Taiwan that are in favor of maintaining the status quo. Basically means Taiwan maintain its de facto independence without announcing formal independence.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Jing, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Jing Sun, professor of political science at the University of Denver, also a UW-Madison alumnus. He joined us to talk about Secretary of State Antony Blinken's recent trip to China, what it means for the future of the international relations between those two countries, and about Taiwan.